Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the New Books Network in Environmental Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Aspen Brown, a host of the channel and currently an MA candidate at the University of Wyoming, studying cultural history with a focus on environment, science, and knowledge. Today, we'll be talking to Elizabeth Irvin Blankenheim about her new book, Song of the Earth: Understanding Geology and Why It Matters, published by Oxford University Press in 2021. Elizabeth Irvin Blankenheim, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Aspen. I really appreciate it.
Well, and thank you for coming on today. I'm really excited to talk about your book, but before we dive into it, would you begin by telling us a bit about yourself and your background?
Oh, I'd love to. I am a geology instructor at Front Range Community College in Fort Collins, so not far from University of Wyoming. And before that, I was a geologist with the U.S. Geological Survey for many years and had a career doing hydrology and groundwater studies in New Jersey and Nevada at Yucca Mountain. But my interest in science was sparked by my sixth grade science teacher, Mrs. Heilman, in general science. But I'll just never forget she made it so relevant and interesting. And I've always had a passion for science in general and geology specifically. So I went to my undergraduate college, Dickinson College in Pennsylvania. And I actually majored in anthropology, but I was really interested in archaeology and how geology would influence archaeological sites. So I started to study geology and decided to take, we had a program where you could go for a whole year and get a second major. And that's what I decided to do. And I continued on doing some geoarchaeology for a while. But then I started working for the federal government at the EPA in Philadelphia, Environmental Protection Agency. And they said, well, it's really better to have not to do two different careers in terms of the geoarchaeology. And I was looking into hydrology at that time. So I carried on and I decided to focus on geology and hydrology, the study of water, and soon transferred to the U.S. Geological Survey and ultimately ended up here in Denver in Colorado, working on the Yucca Mountain Project and then doing fracture network studies and a lot of groundwater modeling and writing reports, many, many reports. And then I've retired a bit early, but I went on to start my teaching kind of career, I guess you could say. And I decided before I did that, I did get my licensure in, I am a professional geologist. And what that entails is sitting for an exam, a pretty intensive exam that I studied for a year. I took the exam and passed, and the people who had offered the review course asked me to come teach with them. So I did that for 12 years. And in the interim, I applied to Front Range Community College, and we had moved to Colorado at this time. We had been back in Pennsylvania for a while. And I started as a part-time professor in geology. And I don't know, my students just inspired me to write this book. So it was quite a process. So I hope that answers your question.
Yes, and it leads into the next question I have, which, you know, what since you're kind of inspired by your students writing this book, what really like drove you to write it in the way you did?
Well, my students they have such enthusiasm for geology, even though many are non-majors, and this is probably one of their only science classes, but they, especially for environmental geology, which is the first course I taught at Front Range, and even then physical geology, the students were so interested in how human life and humans intersect with geology and all the aspects of, you know, how we study water and rocks and minerals and the age of the earth. And it really touches on every aspect of our lives. We just don't often realize it. So they wanted to know more after my classes. And I thought, well, and to back up a step, I had a friend and colleague who said to me one day, you should write a book. And I told her, what book? I never thought of writing a book. And so those two things, my students and then this friend and colleague saying that I should write a book, ended up in me starting to work on Song of the Earth.
And you know what? You set me up just perfectly for a next question I have. And can we explore the title a little bit? Because it's Song of the Earth, Understanding Geology and Why It Matters. So the subtitle is, I think, you've answered. But what does the Song of the Earth mean to you, and why was that the title that you went with?
Oh, that's a great question. Well, I believe the Earth has its own agency, if you will, and even there is a vibration that the Earth puts out. I forget the kilohertz, but there is sort of this vibration, a planetary vibration that the Earth emits. But I just thought that the Earth has, in a sense, its own voice, and it speaks to us through the lens of geology. So the Earth has its own processes and things that occur, whether they be slow and steady processes that like ended up with all the rocks of the Grand Canyon or more catastrophic processes, such as when the asteroid hit the Earth 66 million years ago, ending the Mesozoic and all of the lives of the non-avian dinosaurs at the end of the Cretaceous. So I just think we live in a geologic world, and we are actually geologic beings. And it just seemed to me that to give the Earth that voice, and how do we know what we know, was the reason I picked the title.
That's really beautiful. And the content of your book and your thought process within something like the title, I think really shows your transdisciplinary talents and all of your experience that you've gathered from sixth grade on. So that's really neat. And kind of building in the because a lot of times for me, when we speak about geology, the human seems to be left out. So I really thought it was interesting that that the human, you know, you're building the human into this narrative in such a cool way. And the first two chapters are also about the roots of geology as a scientific practice. Why did you start there?
Well, that is sort of what we call the nature of science and how do we know what we know. And in geology, it traces back, at least the Western scientific view of geology, traces back to the, you know, beginning of the 16th century, back to Steno and all the discoveries. And I just have to say, as an aside, there are other ways of knowing. And there's many indigenous methodologies concerning geology that are fascinating that I wasn't able to touch on in this book, but I hope down the road to do that. But this was from a Western scientific view. And I thought the stories, the narrative approach would be kind of be a way to engage my readers, to have them understand that these early geologists were people and they had their struggles and they had their moments of not knowing or just, there's so many incredible stories that are make up the sum total of what we've learned.
Yeah, and that's really it, that the process of exploring comes across really well in those chapters, and in your intro you do acknowledge that this is one segment of a knowledge base coming from this Enlightenment perspective. So I appreciate that you do acknowledge that there are other viewpoints and other wisdoms out there that we can engage with, and this one specific discipline of geology is not the only thing we can consider. The idea of narrative is really interesting though, because as a historian, we talk a lot about grand narrative and how a lot of these thinkers in the 18th and 19th century, not only were looking at the past, but they were looking at the future and trying to project what the world would be like. But now we're sitting at a kind of a point where you ask in your third chapter, are we living at the end of time? And so would you talk about, because your third and fourth chapters are about time, would you talk a little bit about the importance of geologic time and why that question, are we living at the end of time, is important?
Oh, well, thank you. Well, geologic time is such a basic fundamental tenet in geology that everything else is pretty much wrapped around it. And it's the focus of my book. And also, I didn't get to say before, but I have, this book has inspired me to do even more. So I am in my doctoral program, almost about to graduate. Hopefully.
Oh, wow. Congratulations.
Thank you. I'm working on my dissertation as we speak, and today rather. And I'm almost there. It's been a journey too. But my topic is geologic time, as inspired by the book. So if we think of the Earth's biography and the long 4.6 billion years of Earth's history, it's almost unfathomable in regard to like a human life, the length of a human life. And how do we help people understand that? And it's almost inconceivable because of our own time frame. So I try to do that, to bring that about by showing like the spiral of geologic time, which is one of the color illustrations, and then going through the biography of the Earth. And then again, how did we figure out all the, just talking about the time scale itself of the Earth. It's just so amazing how we uncovered it. And it's been, the analogy I like to use is, think of a huge book, you know, maybe a 1,000 page long, and you take it, and this is a travesty in a sense, but you rip it apart and you scatter the pages around, and somehow they get burnt in a forest fire and then doused with water. And and then buried in soil. And then someone comes along years later and tries to find these pieces of the book. And the book is the story of the earth, the biography. And then they try to put it back together. That's what geologists and stratigraphers, those who study strata and sediments and the layering of the earth, have tried to do. And it is an incomplete record, but I think it's amazing that we've been able to figure this out since the late 1500s to today. So that was a big part of it. And then with the advent and advance of radioisotopes and the studies in science, we can actually pin down those dates of the boundaries between the different periods of the geologic timescale. So there is, I would still say, some pushback to the idea of the timescale itself, which is interesting. And we try to, as scientists, to help people understand the great age of the Earth. But sometimes people have been raised in other traditions, and that can be a challenge for them. So that comes up occasionally in my teaching. And I would say to my students, I always try to listen to what they have to say and then show them the scientific evidence and tell them the story of the Earth and through the class. So geologic time is, everything else is wrapped around it. That's why it's the first major principle in the book. So after the history of the different geologists, I go on to the principles, and starting with that and going into the details and some of the controversies around the divisions of the time scale and all. But, and it gets, I had to go back, and luckily I could read a bit of Latin and some French, but I had to go back to original sources to like suss out some of these, you know, articles that held, like Cuvier. So some of the French paleontologists and even some Latin with Steno. So it is such a vital principle, and everything else hangs on it in geology. So again, telling the story of how we figured it out and what it means. And in terms of like now, our present state on the Earth, it is, I don't know, it's a big question. And we can talk about that as we go.
Yeah, I really hope to. But before we do that, you talked about the first principle, and then the second principle you bring up is plate tectonics, and you donate two chapters to that as well, 5 and 6. Would you like to speak just a little bit about the importance of plate tectonics? And
sure, I would love to. Plate tectonics is, when I was in school, so I'll age date myself a bit, plate tectonics was not even taught, because it's a very recent theory. And we call it a theory not because we're uncertain of it, but because it's still scientifically considered a theory. And it's a very high level of proof, but still we're talking about science, and it is, so we call it the theory of plate tectonics, or sometimes just plate tectonics. But it is a unifying theory. So really what spurred the development of the theory of plate tectonics was World War II. And the sensing and radar imaging they could do of the ocean floor. Because before that, scientists and people thought the ocean floor was just a flat abyssal plain and nothing was happening down there. And it was boring and uniform, and little knowledge was known about it before remote sensing, the ability to see beyond our eyes. And the equipment and sonar and radar from World War II started to allow us to see a bit of the mechanism of plate tectonics. But before that, even in the early 1900s, people noticed, as they started to explore the Earth, and before the 1900s even, how the continents might have, they seemed to mirror each other like puzzle pieces almost. And people wondered about this. And Alfred Wegener was an early proponent of continental drift. So he was not a geologist. And as you've probably read, his theories of the drifting continents were widely criticized because he was not among those in the field who knew each other. You know, he was just different. But it turned out to be true. And World War II allowed us to see like how this could occur with the discovery of the mid-ocean ridges and the plate boundaries that we could actually see with remote sensing under the ocean floor. So the continents are totally and always in motion, different rates in different places. And what it has led to is, if you think of all the earthquakes in the world and volcanoes and economic deposits and ore bodies, it's all tied together with how the plates have moved over geologic time because of the stresses produced at the different plate boundaries. So before plate tectonics, we really had no idea why earthquakes occurred where they did or why mountains rose up in certain places. There were theories, but nothing really made a lot of sense. So it's a unifying grand theory, and it's been proved. Now we can measure plate movement with global positioning satellite GPS tracking and actually see the vectors produced over time. And it's changed everything in geology. So
And it's really interesting to see how technology plays a role in this Western understanding of all of this, of this whole narrative, especially after the 19th century. And in your third principle, it seems like DNA was kind of this last step of really understanding biodiversity and ecosystems and extinction. And you say that evolution is the third principle. So why is evolution the third principle, and why is that important?
Well, evolutionary changes, we can see the fossil record. So the record of former life on the planet is what we call a fossil record. And it is an incomplete record, but we have enough evidence to show changes in life forms and species over the huge span of the Earth's biography. And until Darwin came along and his colleagues, it was really unclear. There were other theories, even theories of the flood. And some early geologists held to that, like Buckland. But over time and with more evidence, evolution is another overarching theory that helps us understand how these changes could have occurred. And it's really interesting because if you see, still even today, you'll see a lot of, you go to a museum and you might see how, say, the horse ancestors and species changed over the length of the Cenozoic, the most recent part of the Earth's history. And it's shown in a very straight line, like one animal, one horse ancestor evolving to the next one. And it's really not like that. It's much more complex. It's more like a branching vine than a straight line. And that is a misconception that sometimes creeps into some museum displays. But evolution is sort of that linchpin that relates life to the geologic record and how it changed over that great time. So it's, to me, those are the three major principles in geology, and everything else flows from them.
Yeah, that's so beautiful. And something you said earlier really, really caught my imagination of seeing beyond our eyes. And the next part of the book, after your chapter on evolution, is five different chapters, 8 through 11, on the elaborating on the geological errors, and you call this the biography of the Earth. And before we really get into that part, one thing that I have a question of, and one thing I've struggled with as is just kind of trying to learn about geology throughout the years, is you're talking in this section about like years of millions of years. So each of these eons or eras take place over millions of years. And I have a really hard time wrapping my head around that concept of that stretch of like deep time. Do you have any advice about how do you like to approach imagining the conception of what a million years actually means?
I think that's a wonderful question, Aspen. And one way to do that is to, you can think of your own body. It's like starting with your breastbone and going out to your fingertips on your arm. If you start at your breastbone and work out, like 88% of the geologic record would go out to your wrist, and that would be the whole Precambrian era before life really burgeoned out. So if we can relate it to something we know, another way you could like walk a trail of time. They have that at the Grand Canyon. But going back to our arm analogy, and you stretch out, you say your right or left arm, and that time from the birth of the Earth to the rise of the of life, as we in the Cambrian period, that stretches all the way from your breastbone to your wrist. So 88% of the geologic record is sort of in that Precambrian time, where it's just lots of things happen, but we don't have a lot of, we have some knowledge, but not a lot. And then going from your wrist out to your fingertips is what we call the Phanerozoic. And that's this visible life eon. And it's, so a lot of things happen, and kind of you get from your arm to your hand, you have a lot more flexibility and fingers, and lots of things are occurring where life is developing. So this is one analogy that might be helpful to students and maybe to you too. And then just understanding it takes time to understand geologic time. And it's something we as in professors and instructors struggle with too. Like how do we teach it? In my doctoral study, some of my participants who are seasoned professors still struggle with the depth of geologic time. So I think just dipping your toe in it time and again, so to speak, and coming back to the stories is very helpful, because a million years in that time scale of the Earth is a blink of an eye.
Yeah, it's so mind-blowing. And I was so interested in thinking about how you write this book, because my thesis covers, you know, the 40 years between 1880 and 1920, and I'm having a hard time explaining that. And you're covering these gigantic swaths of time. And when you were writing the book, did you run into challenges with how you were going to address such a big amount of time in such a small amount of space?
It's so interesting. The book just sort of flowed out of me. I started in 2016 to write, and I don't know if just all the years of doing geology and being a geologist and instructor helped, but you know, as we go further back in the time scale, we have, as I said, less evidence. So I delved a little bit into the birth of the Earth, and it's pretty, there's a lot of good theories, whether it was, you know, hot early Earth or not as hot. We're learning more all the time from physics and astronomy too. But I think Stephen Hawking's book helped me a bunch, was A Brief History of Time. I've read that several times. And having kind of a perspective, even outside of the Earth, looking at the universe and the physics. I think in my, maybe an alternate life, I would have loved to have been a theoretical physicist. So it kind of puts it in perspective to me that the universe is 13 billion years old. And then, you know, you have all the accretionary disks and the forming of the stars. And I do teach that. I touch on that in my classes because it's part of our curriculum. So I think organizing the book was, I guess I came to it from that viewpoint of even a broader viewpoint.
Cool, cool. And I really think that it reads really well, and that flow is there. So
thank you. I mean,
obviously, you're an expert in the field, and you know exactly what you're talking about and how it needs to be addressed. These ideas of geologic time and deep time, and then using some examples. And I mean, I don't think we can touch on all of the examples of kind of the geologic features that you touch on throughout these chapters. But one that was really interesting for me was very early on, the 2,500 million years ago, the Cheyenne Belt formed, and you talked about that. Would you like to talk about, you know, maybe the Cheyenne Belt and a few other features that really demonstrate the song of the Earth and why you decided to choose those particular examples, like throughout your book?
Oh, sure. I'd love to delve into that a bit. So yes, back in the Precambrian, so any time before the 600 or so million years ago, in the depths of the geologic time, is this event. So with the continents, they were microcontinents to start, as the layers started to develop and the Earth started to cool. And there still were tectonics. It did change quite a bit from the earliest Earth to when plate tectonics got underway in the sense that we know it today. But this event that resulted in what we call the Cheyenne Belt is remarkable. And just to define, so the Cheyenne Belt is a zone that runs northeast, southwest from pretty much about the state line of Colorado and Wyoming, a little bit down into Colorado, and then toward Cheyenne, Wyoming, hence the name. And it's called a shear zone, which is where actually two pieces, there was an outlier of, so you have an island arc of islands and then a proto-continent, and they smashed together and it created this zone of the most stunning rocks I have ever seen in my life. And just as an aside, we went up to the Snowy Range about when I was writing the book, and drove up through Laramie and then up to the Snowies through Centennial, Wyoming, and going up over, it's a pass, a mountain pass that's closed in the winter, and it was open, I think it was spring, and my husband was driving, and we went up and up, and there's a ski area you go by, and kept going up. And at the top of the pass, I just said to my husband, stop the car. Something crazy and amazing happened here. You know, I have to get out and look. And honestly, the rocks were just standing practically vertically. I don't know if you've been there, but you have to go if you haven't. And they were shining in the sun, these white quartzites, which is like a sandstone that's been heated and pressurized. So it's a metamorphic rock. And they're just gleaming in the sun, creating these amazing mountains. And I just had to find out what had happened. So I got a geologic map, which are beautiful, by the way. And I started researching what the heck happened in the Snowies to yield this most incredible scenery. And what happened in between, as the two pieces of continents or the outlying island arc smashed into the protocontinent and then sheared, meaning it kind of went sideways, what was caught in between were these sands and then the earliest forms of life, which were the blue-green algae that created these what we call stromatolites, these mounds, algal mounds. And there's still some today on the Earth in Australia and the Bahamas. But they were captured in between and not totally destroyed. And even the clays, so it went from sands to these carbonate rocks where the stromatolites that they created, and then the clays all trapped, all made into, so the original rock was sandstone. And then we had the carbonate made from the stromatolites, which is calcium carbonate, and then deeper water clays. And they were captured in between and heated and pressurized, made into metamorphic rocks, but not destroyed. And you can still see some of the biggest stromatolite deposits that I know of. And some are 15 meters across. And they're the earliest life forms on the planet. Well, there's ancient bacteria, but these stromatolites are remarkable because they helped in the evolution of our atmosphere and the oceans to make our oxygen-rich atmosphere because they were photosynthesizing. And it's all in your backyard. And if you haven't been there, I strongly urge you to go.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
I don't know if I've been to that particular spot or if I saw it. I didn't have the specific eyes to be able to understand all of the power there, but there was a little bit of a geological like nepotism there, just because I do really like that area. But one thing that I've always felt that there's this really old power there, or you know, some kind of, I mean, it is awe-inspiring to just get up into those mountains and be curious about how did these come around and when and all of that. So thank you very much for that lovely description. And you really you moved us into the younger part of the Earth now, with talking about early life and getting into life where you say it's kind of the last 12% of the story, I think, unless I have that wrong a little bit, but
no, you're right on.
Okay, perfect. And one phrase that really popped out in one of the chapters, I think it was from Stephen Gould, about the weird wonders of life that came about, especially, you know, in these early parts of the time. Do you want to talk about kind of these early life forms and how,
sure,
evolution kind of, we can understand evolution from this time period?
Well, the some of the earliest life forms emerged before the Cambrian period, and they were in the form of small shelly fossils, and life developed in the oceans first. And emerged later, but it became more and more complex. And some of the early work was done in what we call the Burgess Shale, and that was a formation in Canada, or is a formation in Canada. So it's a shale deposit, and I think the workers, there was some kind of mine, and they found these, what they called fossil bugs. So they did have geologists come examine the rocks. And this is in, I think, Mount Stephen in Canada, in the western part of Canada. And they were found to be this amazing set of fossils that lived together at the same time, even including what we call little trilobites. These are kind of segmented arthropod-type creatures, and picaea, which are a predatory creature. And they were captured they think there was an underwater landslide that captured all of these fauna together and allowed scientists to start to study like who lived together and when. We can age date those rocks, which have been done, so we know how old they are through isotope dating. And so just knowing sort of the ancient environments and then looking at tracing through time how the life forms changed is what we're talking about with evolution. So that would be kind of the one I would point to.
Cool. And the other really startling thing, looking back and moving throughout all of these different time periods, is the idea of extinction along with this evolution, where you talk about how only 0.1% of life that exists today. And it's just like a lot of the time existed without us. There's this huge scope of time that where life both lived and died and continued to change. And that's just so fascinating to me. And it's so, I mean, it's mind blowing. I don't know if you'd like to talk about, you know, is there like one extinction that you think is really, really prominent or important to note?
Well, I think we all kind of think of the end of the dinosaurs, that extinction. But the largest extinction was the one at the end of the Permian that closed the Paleozoic times. And like almost 95% of life was wiped out at that time. And they call it the Great Dying. So it was a time when the last supercontinent started to split apart, Pangaea. And I would say it was a violent birth of the smaller continents. So Pangaea was this huge supercontinent. And we can still see, even here in Colorado and Wyoming, you can see these had massive sand dunes in the middle of it. Some of it was along the equator, so there were tropical coal deposits and swamps. But the sandstones are preserved, the dune deposits, the structures are preserved that we can still see today. But as it started to split apart, it rifted through plate tectonics. And it was just a violent process where as it rifted, more volcanics flowed out of those rift zones, and it set on fire old coal deposits, and it started creating ash and soot in the atmosphere, and basically a time of global cooling. So the food chain collapsed in the oceans and on land, and some species made it through. But it was a difficult time for life, for sure. But it led to, when you have these extinction events, what happens is then there's a recovery period. And life soldiers on, in a sense. And the new niches and ecological niches are opened up for different species. So this led to the age of the dinosaurs and all those many varieties of the dinosaurs that we know and loved as kids and even today.
That's poetic in itself and in a strange way. And I love how in that example we can see all of the principles in there, from the plate tectonics to understanding ecosystem and how these changes, geological changes, impact the ecosystem, which impact the way that life will interact with its environment. And one astounding thing about this extinction, I think you call the third great extinction. It took place over 200,000 years, which, as you know, is a flash in the pan, geologically speaking. But to kind of rip us back into our present era, it's so fascinating, all of the and terrifying about to consider all of the changes we have experienced in the last 500 to 200 to even the last few centuries. And I don't know if you want to speak on that side of things in terms of looking at the contemporary issue of climate change, contextualized within this greater narrative of the Earth.
Well, that's a great lead in to the last chapter and sort of wrapping it all up into the implications for our current world and the planet and what we're facing. So I do think geology can provide sort of a different understanding of climate and change. And we're facing events that are occurring much more swiftly than we've ever seen in the geologic record, that a lot of these extinctions happened over, as you said, hundreds of thousands of years, except perhaps the dinosaur extinction was relatively rapid, and we're seeing more evidence all the time that there was just a NOVA series out on the day the dinosaurs died, and it was very dramatic and much more punctuated than some of the other extinction events. But humans are a geologic force. And I like to say we influence the Earth and the Earth influences us as human beings. And the thing with climate is, yes, we've seen hothouse times in the past. And like the Paleocene, Eocene, they call it the PETM, the Paleocene, Eocene Thermal Maximum. So in the beginning of the Cenozoic era, it was very warm and hot, lots of tropical forests, and grasslands had not emerged yet. So as it cooled, you know, we ended up cooling through the whole Cenozoic into the ice ages. And there's been that kind of flow and ebb of warming and cooling. But there have been other times, and this is the kind of almost warning from the geologic record, that things can shift rather dramatically. So barring asteroids, things on the planet can shift. And even going back to the Precambrian times, we had times of snow house or ice ball Earth, where things were frozen, and then they would suddenly shift. So we have to be careful that there are tipping points, which is a concept from economics. But still, you know, you weigh the scales to a point where suddenly things can change rather dramatically. The Earth is such a big system. And if we think about the multiple industrial revolutions, which it sounds like some of your work has covered, like how we've been adding carbon to the air, through the burning of fossil fuels. And now we're seeing the impacts of a warming climate through increased greenhouse gases. And people, I think, don't understand that we need these greenhouse gases to survive. It provides that warm blanket around the Earth for life. But if we have tampered with the system so much that now it can't regulate itself, it's truly a concerning time. And we're seeing more rapid changes. Of course, I follow the UN IPCC, you know, reports, and they're saying we have 3 years now to get this under control, which I am a hopeful person, but I have great concern.
Yeah, I echo those thoughts as well. And one thing that I'm really interested in considering time is also like, so one of the first classes in my grad program that I took was called the Letters of Science, and it was a creative writing class, and we read Stephen Gould's Time Cycle, and it got me thinking about the different ways that we perceive time. And then I've been considering a lot about how the implications about things like microplastic or the radiation that we've introduced through either atomic bombs or nuclear power, and the linear implications of those within the framework of geology, and then even thinking about kind of industrial or urban scapes and how those, like, is there a way that we can think of all of these things as part of geography or geology, even if they seem very artificial from past experiences of the Earth?
I think so. I think it's all interrelated and can be related to geology, but that is my lens. But yes, I think an interesting story with the nuclear waste and even nuclear above ground testing and the fallout is that, those particles, those radioactive particles have been captured in lake sediments, and they're actually being considered as a time marker for the newest geologic period, the Anthropocene. So it would be very concerning because we've ended the Holocene. We're pretty much sure we've ended the Holocene. It's just that stratigraphers are trying to find that marker bed it has to be permanent, to be documented. They actually use a golden spike to mark it, and they have to age date it, which they could do. But your point to urban cities, and there is a whole field of urban geology, which it was really started in, I believe, Canada in the 70s and 80s, but it's becoming more important as we find greater than 50% of the population in the U.S. lives in cities, and most of these cities are on coastlines, so the east or west coasts. So they are going to be impacted by many geologic factors, even without talking about climate change. Think of California and the earthquakes and the population that, the population is living in an active tectonic boundary where the Pacific plate is diving down under the North American plate, creating a big trench. And the earthquakes are caused by all those tectonic processes. But when you introduce climate as well, and the ice sheets are being subject to the warming and melting, so they store a lot of fresh water. And then that water is being added back to the oceans and actually slightly diluting the salt content. But anyway, sea level rise, especially for coastal cities and populations, is huge. So in that sense, we have geologic impacts. And a lot of these cities are built along what we call the fall line. I don't know if you've heard that term. So where the coastal plain sediments meet the more hard rock Piedmont sediments. And it goes back to the history of when ships came from the explorers and settlers. They could navigate only so far up the river to the fall line. And that's pretty much where in the east and the Atlantic coast, a lot of the cities are placed right there where they could no longer navigate. So that's where Philadelphia and Boston and, a lot of these coastal cities are placed. And as sea level rises, the incidence of daytime flooding or daylight flooding is these flooding events are occurring more and more frequently. And I think my biggest concern for these urban areas is, a couple concerns. So you have how are they producing or getting energy and water and food sources, because a lot of food growing areas will be threatened by climate change. All the river delta areas where the five huge worldwide river deltas that grow a huge amount of food for the world could be inundated by salt water. This is not in the U.S. per se, but it's a time of, I think it has to be our number one priority. I call it an all hands on deck moment. And it's why I decided to go on and do my doctoral work. And like the book is, I loved writing the book, but I feel like I have to do even more to help, because we all have to do everything we can, I believe, to, I don't know if we can avert it at this point, but maybe mitigate this climate crisis.
Sure. At least stay with the trouble, as Donna Haraway would say.
Yeah.
But I mean, a book like Song of the Earth, I think, is a really good jumping off point to really trying to engage with these topics and these conversations in a maybe a more gentle way or a more understanding way. And maybe by really allowing us to look deep into the past, it will create some kind of, it will allow for our imaginations to run and maybe start thinking about things in different ways and collaborating in different ways, because we see how immense everything is. It might put us in more of a platform of like, we need to work together. Like you said, all hands on deck. And I feel like I'm leaving this interview both inspired and a little terrified, which might be a good position to be in. But with that, we have taken up a lot of your time. And before you go, I'd like to just open the floor up to any last comments you have. And then if you'd like to tell us what your plans are moving forward, maybe after you get this PhD,
we would
love to hear it.
Well, I hope that people feel inspired by my book, and also that to know that geology nurtures us, that it's anywhere we go, there it is. And it can be a source of great support in our lives. And I just see it, like you can go out and Virginia Dale is a little place just north of us between here and Wyoming. And there's this amazing like volcanic structure that's 15 kilometers across, and it's very ancient too. And just knowing it's such a special place, Virginia Dale, and the Snowies, and even here along the Front Range where we had the ancient Cretaceous Seaway, just knowing that these stunning things are out there and they're so fascinating to see is, I think, a way of nurturing our soul and our, you know, bodies, and getting out in nature. The Japanese talk about sort of that nature bathing idea. I would say do geology bathing. Get out and see some rocks and take a geologist with you. And in terms of my plans, I do hope to offer I have some virtual field trips that are kind of fun, that go into some of these cool kind of geologic features. And I'm working on a second book. It's tongue-in-cheek, called Calamities, Disasters and Catastrophes in the Geologic Record. And it's written for general public, and it focuses on these happenings in the geologic record, not to dismiss the slow and steady processes, but actually my agent is so interested in this topic that he's, so I have a draft out for publisher review, and I haven't heard back yet, but that is in my, hopefully in my future. And then as I finish my doctorate, this hopefully as soon as possible, we'll see what comes up, whether I'm very interested in policy work. And I think hopefully figure out the path as I go forward. So I'll be applying for the American Association for the Advancement of Science, probably a fellowship to do science policy, perhaps in DC, or looking for full-time teaching positions, or continue on at Front Range, which I love and adore. So some kind of outreach, my doctorate's in scientific and geologic literacy, helping people understand, trying to kind of translate geology for the public. And I'm learning all the time. I'm so grateful for the journey. And thank you so much, Aspen, for your time and your great questions. And I just hope you have a chance to get out and see some geology in the field, so to speak.
It has been my pleasure, and thank you for coming on. And I'm excited for your new publications, and I'm excited for when the next generation of geologists come through. They're going to be writing about you in their books as this next chapter, I think. So thank you so much for coming on and your time today. And I hope you have a wonderful day and good luck with all of your endeavors.
Thank you.